Our next case for argument is Lindquist Ford against Middleton Motors.
May it please the court. This case boils down to two basic issues. The first is, did Lindquist Ford reasonably expect that it would only be compensated on the basis of a percentage of any real income profits that were earned? And the record is clearly yes. The second issue is, did Middleton Motors earn a profit during the tenure of Mr. Miller as general manager or within the 3 years following the determination? And the record is clear that that answer is no. Now, the district court made three basic errors. It failed to apply the correct law of quantum merit and unjust enrichment. It made findings that had no support in the record, and it drew speculative inferences that had no support in the record and, in fact, contradicted the direct evidence that's in the record. Let me address the failure
to... Mr. Steichen, did you consent to have Judge Krabs stay with the case on remand?
Yes, we did not ask for a different judge.
Well, it's supposed
you don't
to be
need
automated.
To ask for one. Circuit Rule 36 requires an automatic assignment to a different judge when we reverse a case after a trial. So Judge Sykes' question was whether the two parties stipulated that Judge Crabb could continue hearing the case notwithstanding that rule.
We did not expressly stipulate, but obviously we agreed to proceed with Judge Crabb.
I don't understand how one can agree to disregard a rule of this court that governs the proceedings on remand tacitly. Now, of course, you haven't raised this issue in your brief. One reason why I'm concerned, and I assume Judge Sykes is concerned, is because your brief says, look, it looks like the district judge was being defensive, just trying to reach the same result as before despite the reversal. That's exactly why we have Circuit Rule 36. And it's very difficult for a litigant to make that argument if you had a perfect right to a different judge and decided not to use it.
The reason, I admit I was not aware that there was a requirement of the circuit's...
So you don't know about Circuit Rule 36. You can hardly have waived it. How one could not know about Circuit Rule 36, I don't know. Of course, you're not arguing that in your brief.
Right. But part of the reason that we didn't have an objection to proceeding with Judge Crabb is that this court's decision in the first appeal was so explicit, not only what as to what the elements of quantum merit are, but how to apply this law to the facts of this case with the evidence that had been excluded in the first trial being introduced. We just thought that was so clear that that should not be a problem on remand. The district court, despite the opinion, continued with the same error of law that it made the first time around, which was that if there was no contract, and it's agreed there was no contract in this case, then the parties could not have reached an agreement on basic terms and key terms, including compensation. Now, contracts are a subset of agreements. You can have parties reach agreement and yet not have a legally enforceable contract. That can be for various reasons. Might be for the statute of frauds. And in this case, the parties had agreed that there would not be a contract until there was a document spelling out all of the terms and that that would be signed by both sides. It was so extreme that every time counsel at trial attempted to ask whether the parties had reached an agreement, an understanding, the judge sustained objections that because there was no contract, the parties could not have agreed. The second error was that the district court turned first to the unjust enrichment claim and performed its own analysis of what the court thought would be just under the circumstances, and then basically simply said, same analysis, and so they'll prevail in quantum merit. In this court's decision on the first appeal, it was, we thought, perfectly clear that the first issue to be addressed is quantum merit, and that if Lindquist Ford's reasonable expectations were that it was to be paid only on a percentage of profits basis, then the quantum merit, and assuming there's no profit, that the quantum merit case should be dismissed, and that if that's the case, there was no injustice in holding Lindquist to that agreement, and the unjust enrichment case should also be dismissed. The reasonable expectations could not be more clear on the facts of this case. There is contemporaneous, undisputed, and unequivocal document that establish those that expectation of compensation based on percentage of profits. Now, we have in the record and have argued in the brief the series of documents through the negotiations, Mr. Miller's notes from a meeting before he started work, the exchange of memos between accountants for the two sides, and then the letter of understanding that sets out the compensation provisions, which Lindquist has admitted throughout this case that that is what they understood to be the terms of compensation.
I don't think Judge Crabb fundamentally disagreed with that. She just thought that the plaintiffs had turned the dealership profitable, but then it seems to me entered into a separate finding in tension with that, finding that they had succeeded in turning the dealership profitable by saying that they didn't have a fair attempt to do so.
That was one of the...
There wasn't really any quarrel on her part that the expectation and understandings of the parties were that any compensation would be profit-based.
Well, first of all, you have to look at the record. Every time we attempted to introduce or to ask questions about Lindquist Ford's agreement with the terms of the letter of understanding, Judge Crabb sustained an objection. And the court allowed only very narrowly phrased questions on that. So that evidence didn't get into the record from testimony. It was only through the documents. But what Judge Crabb ruled was that this wasn't a contract, therefore there was no agreement, and that Lindquist Ford met the exceptions that this court had posed as possible exceptions to the dismissal of the quantum merit and unjust enrichment claims, that they didn't have a fair opportunity. Now, all the court has to do is look at one document which unequivocally shows that that was not Lindquist Ford's understanding, that this claim of lack of fair opportunity was only raised once this court explained that that could be an exception. The one document is the May 11, 2004 letter from Lindquist Ford to Middleton Motors. That was approximately 6 weeks after the termination of the relationship. The letter says, "We have reviewed all of the records, including our notes involving the relationship. We have reviewed it with our attorneys, and our conclusion is that you owe us 53% of the real income profit for 2003 and termination fees in accordance with the letter of understanding," expressly refers to the letter of understanding, and then the terms that they set out are the terms of that letter of understanding, namely, it would obtain 50% of profits between $500,000 and $1 million over 2 years. If the profits were over $1 million, they would get 50% for 3 years after termination. It's undisputed in the record that, and actually Judge Crabb did not find that they were profitable, nor did Lindquist Ford argue that there was a real income profit for 2003. What they said was, and what Judge Crabb said, was they were on the verge of profitability. And the reason for that is that the only testimony about a real income profit came from Craig Miller. He didn't use the correct records for his calculations. He wasn't familiar with GAAP principles, which the letter of understanding said would be applied. Lindquist did not call its accountant who had represented it in the negotiations. The letter of understanding says the adjustments will be those that simply affect a tax shifting to one side, and that would be determined by agreement of the two accountants. So Judge Crabb didn't even find that there was any profit for 2003, and it's been undisputed, and Judge Crabb found, that Middleton Motors was not profitable for 2004, 2005, or 2006, 3 years after termination. It was not until 2007 that there was any profit earned. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Certainly, counsel. Mr. Shoemaker.
Good morning. The trial court's finding that equity requires that Craig Miller, Steve Lindquist, and Lindquist Ford be paid for the value of their services provided to Middleton Motors was not clearly erroneous and was supported by sufficient evidence.
I'd like to follow up on Judge Sykes' question about why Judge Crabb held a second trial. Did Judge Crabb invite the two parties to stipulate that she could continue hearing the case?
Not explicitly, Your Honor. What happened at the, I'm sure you're aware that in the Western District of Wisconsin, at the time there was only one judge presiding, one Article III judge presiding.
Only one active judge at the time.
Right. And others helping.
I have designated at least six other judges to hear cases in the Western District of Wisconsin. And they are providing substantial services. There is no doubt whatever that we had judges available to hear this case.
I understand. We had a preliminary pretrial conference on remand handled by Magistrate Judge Crocker. And at that preliminary pretrial conference, I asked if the court would rely on the record as previously developed and then just add the additional evidence that was supplemented. I believe that there was an agreement by both parties that that would be appropriate and that Magistrate Judge Crocker said that's what would happen. The court did not explicitly refer to the circuit court rule, nor did anyone else in that discussion explicitly refer to the circuit court rule. Have I answered your question?
It answers my question, but it leaves me most disturbed because it was not proper for Judge Crabb to continue hearing this case without soliciting and receiving express agreement of both parties that that was proper. It is obvious that Mr. Steichen was totally unaware of his rights under the rule and hasn't waived them. Did you notify Mr. Steichen? He seems to have been ignorant of the rule.
Your Honor, I do not believe that I knew at the time of the preliminary pretrial conference that the rule required substitution by the court.
Mm-hmm. All right. Please proceed.
There are several reasons why the court's ruling was not clearly erroneous and was supported by the evidence. On remand, the court considered the evidence of what the parties expected. The evidence was that Craig Miller, Steve Lindquist, and Lindquist Ford expected to perform all of the duties of the general managers to work very hard and to save this dealership from financial failure. They did that, and the evidence showed that. The evidence also showed that plaintiff reasonably expected that they'd be given a fair opportunity to turn the dealership around, to make it profitable, so they could ultimately earn a compensation based on percentage of profits. And that was shown in a couple of different ways. In June, the plaintiffs proposed that if the dealership was terminated before December 31st, 2004, they would be paid a termination fee of $350,000, which if you do the math works out to about $200,000 per year. Sorry. That was not accepted, but in a June meeting with Joe Schwartz, defendant's accountant, they said we'll try to find an alternative to that. And the record shows that on June 23rd, there was a telephone conversation followed by a letter of understanding, which proposed some termination provisions. One of those was that if the relationship was terminated for good cause, then there would be an entitlement to a certain percentage of gross profits for a couple of years going forward. Mr. Miller testified that he understood that when a final agreement was drafted by an attorney, it would provide for termination for good cause on those terms, but it would contain some other language that related to the fact that you couldn't be terminated without good cause.
Right. Well, of course, none of that happened.
What's that?
None of that happened, and this bears upon the reasonableness of your client's expectations
under
the circumstances. Certainly the original termination proposal can't form the basis of a reasonable expectation because it was explicitly rejected in favor of a profits-based.
Right. But what it shows is that, well, first, there never was a final agreement, particularly on the terms of the termination payment, because, in fact, that's why summary judgment was granted, because the defendant successfully showed there was never any meeting of the minds on any termination provisions. But what the course of that negotiation shows is that our client expected a fair opportunity to turn this into a profitable.
And why was 11 months unfair?
Because the testimony of Mr. Neustadt, the expert witness called by the defendant, was that if someone took over a dealership like this, it would probably take more than a year to turn it from losing as much money as it was until it was profitable. Further, the evidence is that as we were getting into late 2003, it was becoming on the verge of profitability. We can't measure profitability because
it
the evidence
wasn't even close.
Well, it was close if you look at some expectation about what real income meant.
Now there wasn't a foundation laid for that testimony. And
we can't prove what real income meant because the letter of understanding says that the final agreement would contain language worked out by the accountants on what real income meant. That never happened. That never went forward. So we can't prove what real income was with certainty. We can prove, though, that, and we did prove, that in January of 2004, Mr. Miller went to Mr. Hudson and said, I think our profit, our fee is going to be about $32,000. And he showed him some rough calculations of what his view of real income was. Now, that was not proven to prove that with certainty, Your Honor, or members of the court, because we couldn't do that, because it would be total speculation to say what real income meant when the parties never agreed on a definition of it. But it shows that both parties saw that we were on the verge of profitability, because Mr. Hudson said, fine, we'll give you the advance that you're talking about. The other thing that Mr. Miller and Mr. Lindquist and Lindquist Ford expected was to be able to own a third of this dealership by paying $500,000. They did not have that opportunity because the defendant dropped the ball and did not follow through on that, probably for good reason, because they were in litigation with their brother over the fact that he was trying to sell his stock in the company to Pat Baxter, who is the owner of Kaiser Ford, a competitor.
How did that prevent your client from making the cash infusion earlier on in the relationship as contemplated?
It didn't prevent them from making the cash infusion, but there was never a final agreement to do so. The sequence of events was on July 23rd, they said they would be willing to do that if they had the opportunity, or if they got stock. In late August, they were presented with, I think it was September 10th, they were presented with the letter of understanding that Joe Schwartz drafted, I think, August 28th. September 10th, they looked at the letter of understanding and says, yes, that looks fine. On September 28th, at a meeting of the 20 group in Iowa, the Hudsons gave them the buy-sell agreement that was contemplated by the letter of understanding, the sample buy-sell agreement, the one that they had with their brother, and said, here's what it is. That's the last they heard of that, of the cash infusion. And then by November 10th, they learned, our clients learned, that the Hudsons were in litigation with their brother. And the court found that nobody ever came to, and the testimony was by our client, that nobody ever came to our client and said, let's do a closing. Here's the stock security. Here's the buy-sell agreement. There was some testimony that they talked to him about that, but I think the court evaluated the credibility of the witnesses. Joe Schwartz said he never asked about it again after, I think, his testimony was August 28th. So they weren't prevented, but there was never any closing to accomplish that because these parties never had a contract. The other thing the evidence shows is that our client was not given a fair opportunity to make this dealership profitable. One of the things that was absolutely clear about the party's expectation was our client would have complete control over the authority and operation of the dealership. And they did that through December, and then in January, when they wanted to exercise that control and start cutting expenses that were near and dear to the hearts of the Hudsons terminated the relationship. These included professional expenses for their friend, accountant, and business advisor, Joe Schwartz, which saved over $50,000, and probably $50,000 a year. And then other expenses of $6,000 for fancy cookies, $6,000 a year for cleaning an aquarium, $6,000 or more for landscaping. All of these things, it was when, as the court found, when our clients began to exercise that authority, then they terminated the relationship. And the court found this analogous to the attorney who on the eve before trial has the rug pulled out from under them.
Well, disputes over fish tank cleaning and cookies are hardly material interferences with their authority over the dealership.
Well, I think you are, Your Honor. $6,000 a year. Excuse me?
Especially considering the changes that your client implemented that are detailed over several pages of the district court's opinion. It looks like your client had substantial control over the dealership, and that to the extent that there were these minor disputes, they didn't inhibit his ability to bring the dealership to the verge of profitability.
Well, $50,000 in professional fees did impact the professionals. Joe Schwartz himself testified that in a dealership where the net profit is 1.5, between 1 and 2%,
And he was replaced.
What's that?
He was replaced. Your client replaced him, right?
Yes, and then he was terminated. He was hired back.
Right, so he wasn't inhibited. Your client was not inhibited from effectuating that change.
Well, they were terminated after they did effectuate that change, and then they hired him back. And the cookies.
The point is that the factual basis for the district court's conclusion that your client was prevented, unfairly prevented from returning the dealership to profitability isn't the facts don't support that.
I think what the facts support is that it's inequitable for our client to have worked for 11 months, to have made all these improvements in the dealership, which
right.
made it.
That's what we said was an improper application of the equitable principles of unjust enrichment and quantum merit in the first decision. So that's the wrong way of looking at the question.
Well, I think what the court said, and I think what the district court did, was it looked at all of those factors and all of the expectations of the parties, including the expectation that our clients would have a reasonable opportunity to make the dealership profitable and not have the relationship terminated when they're on the verge of profitability. And that's the kind of thing that the court looked at, and looked at all those factors, and it found that it was not, that it was would be inequitable for our client to have done everything they said they were going to do.
My point is that the evidence does not support the proposition that the dealership was on the verge of profitability when the relationship was terminated, and the evidence does not support the conclusion that your client was prevented from bringing it to that point during the 11 months in which he had control over the dealership.
I think the evidence that was offered on the point was that the parties acted as if they were on the verge of profitability. When our client went
That can't replace the actual facts. And the actual facts is that the dealership was losing over $250,000 a year.
Right, there'd be no way for us to prove that the dealership received real income because the parties never agreed on the definition.
You could have put on an expert to establish whether it was profitable or not.
Well, but the definition, Your Honor, was not profitability. The definition was to start from GAAP income, which we have, and then to look at definitions of real income.
Why didn't you call an accountant to testify to that issue?
Because if we had called an accountant, his testimony wouldn't have been speculative about what Mr. Woodward and Mr. Schwartz would have agreed to meant real income.
Okay, then that's a proof issue. You've got the burden of proof. This is a failure of proof.
The proof issue, Your Honor, I believe, according to the court's decision, was if our clients show that they were entitled to relief under quantum merit, then they were entitled to the reasonable value of the compensation of a
I'm not
dealer.
Talking about the measure of damages. I'm talking about the question on both equitable remedies, which is whether it was the party's expectations that compensation would be paid on the basis of profits, and if so, and it seems to me there's no dispute about that. Everybody agreed about that.
As long as the dealership was, or the relationship was continuing, there was no agreement on what would happen upon termination.
I understand that. This isn't an agreement-based claim.
Right, that's right. And our objections on agreements in the record related to the questions about what was agreed to on April 21st, 2003, where there was a stipulation, was that there was no agreement reached. But there is no contract in this case, so we cannot prove what real income was and whether or not that was achieved. All we can prove is that our client did everything that was expected of them, and before a year was up,
they didn't pay the $500,000.
And the court found, the evidence showed, that they were not asked to pay the $500,000 after they said that the buy-sell agreement was presented to them, and that the defendants dropped the ball and never presented anything to them or never came to them again, according to their testimony, and Joe Schwartz, the accountant, never came for them again, and that that's understandable because they were in litigation with their brother about the very status of the stock.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Anything further, Mr. Steichen?
I want to respond to the we didn't have fair opportunity, we didn't have full control. I come back to the May 11, 2004 letter that was 6 weeks after the termination, and it's very significant what was not in that letter. There's no claim made that they were entitled to a longer time, that they were prematurely terminated. There is no claim that they didn't have full control, and in fact, the record is replete with all of the changes that were made. They did not make a claim saying we're entitled to a salary or some kind of fixed termination fee. They said we expect the letter of understanding to be applied. Now, That's contemporaneous. The only testimony about, well, he had different expectations, came after this court's decision on the first appeal. And a reasonable person could not look at that testimony and say that's credible in light of their own statements after termination. As far as what decisions they were able to make, as court pointed out, when they wanted to fire Joe Schwartz, they did. And what happened when they terminated him and replaced him with their own accountant, Carl Woodward, is that taxes were not filed on time, paperwork was not being completed. That's very important paperwork under consumer laws. So they hired him back. In conclusion, the relief that Middleton Motors is seeking is a remand with very specific instructions for the entry of a judgment awarding approximately $1,200, which is the net of two undisputed amounts with offset, dismissing the complaint on its merits and awarding costs to Middleton Motors for the trial, in addition to the costs that would be taxed on this appeal. Thank you.
Thank you very much, counsel. The case is taken under advisement.